Talking Tennis with Linda Cirque.
Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Talking Tennis with Linda, powered by the Caversham Lawn Tennis Club, but it is open to absolutely everyone. So welcome as I sit down with those who help make the tennis world go round and find out all about their story. Now on the line, we are very lucky to have a top tennis coach to some of the stars of the court. He was born in Reading, England, but is now living in what I imagine to be a slightly more glamorous setting in Florida, USA. It is Mark Gellard. Hello!
Hey Linda, thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Now, I mentioned that you're in Florida right now, Mark. So could you describe to us your setting? Make us a little bit jealous.
Well, I live in Delray Beach, which is, some people might know Boca Raton a little bit better. They're right next to each other. It's down in South Florida, about 20 minutes, 25 minutes from Fort Lauderdale and about 45 minutes from Miami downtown. Delray is right over on the beach, obviously, because it's Delray Beach. So I live about 5 minutes away from the ocean, which is nice. And obviously the weather's great. It's about 85 today, I think, and it's middle of March. So we're lucky with the weather, and it's a bit of a tennis hotbed. So it's a good place to be.
Oh, I'm so jealous right now. I'm just looking out over a muddy lawn, having been a dull and dreary day in England. So.
Yeah,
I bet
I remember
you don't
those
miss
days.
That part of Reading, that's for sure. And so tell us your typical day then as a coach. What does the day-to-day hold for you?
Well, at the moment, working with a professional player, every day is so different because when you're at a tournament, it's the practice time, the hours are less on court as you're trying to sort of periodize the practices a bit and go from higher volume, lower intensity to more of a lower volume, higher intensity as you get closer to playing matches. So on those sort of pre-match days, and then obviously match days are completely different, where your schedule is really dependent on when you play. And then obviously we have the travel days, which, you know, we just came back now from Dubai. That's, you know, about a 22, 23 hour trip. So it's very different, but typically, you know, the pro players are training 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon during the off season, and then slightly less during the regular season between matches and talk. But there's a big range, amongst the pros, depending on how old they are and physically. You know, Federer, obviously, for example, is not playing that much anymore during the off days, but. Yeah, it really changes a lot, to be honest with you. That's one thing, you have to be, you know, very flexible and dynamic and ready to adapt, because no 2 days are the same.
And before we delve into your career as a coach then, Mark, I mean, I'd like to take you back to where you were born and bred, which is Reading in England, which is where I'm speaking from right now. So tell us a bit about your life in Reading, how you started out playing tennis, and your memories of the Caversham Lawn Tennis Club, which is, of course, your former club.
Yeah, I mean, I have great memories of Caversham. I actually was fortunate that I lived right behind the club and was able to... basically walk through the gate down at the bottom there. And I think I was a bit of an enigma down there. I think probably all the coaches and the members probably were tired of me, because I think I beat that wall to death down at the end of court three there at the bottom. But didn't get a win against it yet. But no, I love tennis, and it was really, you know, a great setting there. I mean, there was a great atmosphere with the junior club nights and the adult club nights, and there was a real community feeling there with everyone, parents. Growing up, the coach that was there back then was Nick Lee. He was my coach growing up there, and then he moved on and went to a different place. So, and then obviously Gary Drake came in and took over and has done an amazing job there with what he's built at Caversham and the surrounding clubs, and put in a great coaching team. And I used to play all the tournaments there, and the club tournaments and the junior tournaments, and it's a great place to play tennis. I mean, just great memories there of playing tennis and learning the game, and really that was where it all started for me. So I'll always have fond memories there and of being in Reading.
And did you stay long in Reading, or did you go off to university?
So I grew up, I was born in Reading and raised there. And then when I was 16, I got a scholarship offer to go train at the Sutton Tennis Academy.
Wow.
Which was, yeah, I think it was just called the Sutton Tennis Academy back then. And then it's changed names a few times since. So I moved up there. I was actually at school at Highdown, which was, you know, in, I think it's up in Emmergreen area. So I used to go to school there. And then when I finished my GCSEs, I took that scholarship and did my A-levels at Sutton, where I could play, you know, 2, 3, 4 hours a day in a structured environment and get fitness. And they had a lot of world-class players training up there at the time. And, you know, likes of Wayne Arthurs and Alex Bogdanovich and Luke Bourgeois, players like this. So it was nice to be around that. And that was really my first sort of introduction into the real professional way of training and preparing.
And were you scouted? Were you spotted? How did you get into that academy?
Yeah, I mean, they were probably pretty desperate to fill up some positions there. And
oh, I was too modest.
At the bottom of the list. But yeah, they did. They offered me a scholarship up there. And it was a fantastic opportunity. I loved it. I loved being up there. And, you know, probably the best couple of years of my life there. Made some great friends and really, you know, improved my tennis, obviously. And then that set the foundation for me to then go to play college tennis.
And you then went off to America, didn't you? University of Alabama. So why did you decide to go overseas?
Well, once I finished the 2 years in Sutton, I kind of knew at that point that professional tennis was not really, I mean, I knew before, but it was probably not going to be a realistic option. So going to college and playing, continuing to play and get a degree at the same time was a real great opportunity for me. And then I had a few universities contacting me and asking me to come out. So I went out there and played college tennis for 4 years. And that was also a great experience, you know, getting a degree, learning a new culture and just improving your tennis, of course, at the same time.
Well, Mark, you make it sound so easy, like people are just flocking to you, offering you all these amazing opportunities. I mean, surely. I mean, how does that all happen?
You know, for me, I was never really talented. I mean, I think probably Gary Drake and all the guys up there, that if they listen to this, they'll attest to that as well, that I was definitely not the most talented player. But I did have a good work ethic, and I loved the game, and I loved practicing, and I just worked hard. That was it. It's cliche, but if you just worked hard and some opportunities came, and then you make the most of what you can.
And so you were playing tennis, but then I think you had an injury, didn't you, which then led you down the coaching path?
Yeah, so my college tennis in the States is 4 years. First, you're a freshman, then you're a sophomore, then a junior, then a senior. And in my start of my senior year, I tore my labrum and rotator cuff. So I ended up having surgery on that. And then you can do something called redshirting, which is where you can maintain your scholarship, keep your scholarship. In exchange, so instead of playing for the team, because I obviously wasn't able to, you can take a position for the university where they will basically allow you to keep your scholarship, and you can either go in and, you know, do something where you can work in the library or the study hall as kind of a payment for your scholarship, or you mm-hmm. can become an assistant coach. So I became the assistant women's coach for the last semester and a half I had in college and loved it. And it was probably the best thing that happened to me actually there, with, you know, being injured was tough, but getting that little chance to be assistant coach and see how it was, you know, in a college coaching environment, and getting my feet wet in general coaching.
And you've been associated with some mega names in tennis. You still are, of course, with Shelby Rogers. But you worked with Martina Hingis and Venus Williams. So can you tell us a bit more about working with them?
Yeah, I mean, again, it was a bit of hard work combined with some luck. Right after I graduated, I came back to England for a couple of weeks. And a friend of mine, who Melanie South, who was a good female player in England, and we were actually at Sutton together training years before, and she was playing down in Eastbourne. So she asked me, I asked her, can I come down and watch you? And she got me a player's badge into the lounge and all that stuff. So it was exciting. And I met a woman in there who happened to be an agent for Octagon, which is a big international company that manages players. So they're like IMG, Octagon, you have Star Wing, Top 5, Top Notch Management, and a few other ones. And Octagon's one of the biggest names in the player management and representation industry. So I talked to her and I said, if you have any openings available for any players, you know, let me know. I'd love to get involved. And actually, I was driving back to Reading that night after the match from Eastbourne, after watching Melanie play, and she called me and said, hey, listen, you know, we met today. I don't really know you. I don't know anything about you, really, but we do have a player that's got a sudden need for some help. So would you be able to start tomorrow at Wimbledon? And I said, sure. Who's the player? And she said, Martina Hingis.
Wow.
And I said, okay, I'll be there tomorrow. And yeah, so I just started off as her hitting partner. And that was about a week before Wimbledon. She was there early to start training. And I remember it rained quite a lot that week. So we were on the indoor carpet courts there over at Wimbledon. And you know, she liked, I suppose I brought some energy and something different, and she liked that. So she asked me to continue on through Wimbledon, and then we did the rest of the US Open series, which was like, I have to remember now where it was. It was back when they had the Acura Classic in San Diego, and then they had the tournament in California, in Carson, and then Cincinnati, and then US Open. So it was a nice run. It was a fun time, and I got lucky there for sure.
And what was she like on and off court?
You know, even to this day, probably one of the nicest players on and off the court. Very respectful. I mean, I was 22 years old, maybe 23 when I was helping her, and she would ask me questions about how I think she should do things, and I'm thinking to myself, I don't know anything. I mean, I knew nothing at that point. And she's won multiple Grand Slams, and I'm kind of bluffing my way around a little bit. But I studied the game a lot, and I watched a lot of her matches to try and figure out, you know, how I could bring something, because I knew I couldn't bring a lot of knowledge at that time. So I had to bring other, you know, values. So it was trying to bring a lot of energy, because at that stage of her career, she was kind of on the way down. So, you know, it's just trying to keep the motivation high. And I think she really used me, because she wanted someone that could, you know, work out in the gym with her, that could run with her on the beach, that could still hit a decent ball to push her in practice. So it was more of just kind of someone that would do that. And I definitely wouldn't say I was her coach, but, you know, I was just helping out in that stuff and trying to keep her engaged. And we had some good times there. It was fun. And she's extremely professional. I mean, the day, you know, a typical day with her was you were up at 6 or 6:30, go eat breakfast. And one thing that's amazing to me with these professional players is how much they can eat.
Really?
I mean, breakfast is, you know, 3 or 4 full plates of food minimum.
Well, not a fry up though, surely.
No, not a fry up, but you'll have at least a whole plate of fruits, and then you'll have a couple of omelets and some, you know, some kind of cereal, and then yogurt. I mean, they can really eat because they're burning so many calories. And then she would work out in the gym for about an hour at about 8 o'clock or 8:30, and then we'd hit the courts for a couple of hours, and then she'd eat lunch, which was usually another 2 entrees she would order. And then we would, you know, usually she would take a nap for about an hour in the afternoon to rest. And then we'd practice again 3 o'clock for another couple of hours. And then she liked to run on the beach or do some cardio stuff after that. So it was a tough day.
She was a machine. Making me tired just listening to you talking.
Yeah, she was a machine.
Wow. And what about Venus Williams? What was she like?
Yeah, so when I was working in Florida after Martina, I kind of made the full move down to Florida to work for Alan Marr, who had an academy called ITA down in Delray. And he had a real good reputation. So we had a lot of good players training there. Alina Vujicova, Tatiana Zanska, and then Venus and Serena lived nearby. So they'd come over from time to time. At that point, Venus was looking for a hitting partner as well. So I just sort of jumped in there for about 5 or 6 months to hit with her whenever she'd come. And she was great. I mean, her dad would come out as well, and he was great. And I always remember he said, you know, Mark, Venus loves hitting with you because you really mix things up when you play with her. You give her different shots, slice, and and deep and short and low and high and fast and slow. And I said, I think that's just a nice way of saying I don't give you a nice consistent ball and I mishit it a lot, but she likes it. So it was, but no, he was great. Very respectful, nice, very nice to me. And so was her dad.
You're now working with the 2020 US Open quarterfinalist Shelby Rogers, who is currently ranked number 49. So what are the main points you've been working on with her?
Well, with Shelby, you know, because I was in China, if you don't mind, I'll back up for a just because when I was in China, we had a lot of players. But after a couple of years there, we had a lot of pro players training there. So we had Zhang Shuai, we had Sai Sai Zheng, we had Magda Linette from Poland, Zarina Diaz from Kazakhstan, and then a handful of other players would come in and train with us. And I started working with Magda Linette, who is Polish, but was also based in China with us. And so for the last 3 years, I was with her. She was ranked about 90, something around that when we started. And I was with her for the last 3 years. And, you know, she had some success. She got up to about 30 in the world. And now I've started with Shelby. It's two completely different players. So I think as a coach, you have to be adaptable to the player you've got, because Magda was a great mover. She was a very consistent player. You know, she had to work for everything very hard. Whereas Shelby now is, I mean, she's one of the, Shelby's one of the best ball strikers in the world. A lot of natural power, big serve, big ground strokes, not as good a mover. So, you know, you have two completely different players and you have to adapt. So the things that I did with Magda, I would never do with Shelby. Shelby has to play first strike tennis. She has to dictate points. She has to be understanding that, you know, she can change the whole match in three swings of her racket. You know, she can really do that. And she's got to be okay with mentally making mistakes, because the way she plays is a little bit higher risk, but it's also a much higher reward. Whereas Magda was, you know, that things weren't so much on her racket. Whereas with Shelby, she often will dictate matches. And if she executes, she's going to win. And if she doesn't, well, she's not. But, you know, just in the last sort of month and a half down in Australia, she had some good wins and beat some top 20 players. But it was, you know, against everyone she plays, maybe with the exception of a Serena or an Osaka, she's going to set the pace and dictate how the matches are played.
And at the time of recording, you travelled with her to Dubai recently for the WTA Championships there. Can you describe what it's like going to a tournament like that as a coach with Shelby? I mean, do you kind of give her not just the physical exercise support, but also mental support as well? I mean, what is your role as a coach whilst you're out on tour with her?
Sure. So we started in Australia for the Open. And the thing is, right now is everything's so different to what even we're used to. So when we got to Australia, we had a 14-day quarantine. So we were in the room for 14 days. But they allowed an exception for the players and a coach to leave the room for 5 hours a day just to go on site to practice. So you got 2 hours of practice, an hour and a half in the gym, and then the remaining, however long it was, hour and I think it was another hour and a half to eat on site. And then you were taken back to the hotel. So right now we're having to get used to every tournament being in a bubble. So you arrive usually 3 days before the event starts. And upon arrival, you'll be tested for a PCR test, will be administered for COVID. And you'll stay in your room until you receive the results back. And once you get the result back, then you can move out of the room, obviously, and you can go back and forth between the hotel room and the courts. But you cannot leave that bubble. So there's no eating out dinner at different restaurants or going out to see anything. You cannot leave the bubble. That's been challenging. As far as my responsibilities, she, at this level, a lot of players have their own psychologist. So she has someone that she speaks with, you know, once a week. And we do a lot of video analysis. So we'll watch a lot of her matches back together and go through things that work, things that didn't work, and identify areas where we can be better. And then we'll do a lot of watching other players and scouting opponents, which is a big part of the tennis at this level, because all the girls can play great tennis. So it's little things here and there. And then setting up you know, I mean, as a coach, your job is to make the life of the player as easy as possible. So if that means booking practice courts, organizing transportation, pick up and drop off times, dropping rackets off to be strung, you know, all of those kinds of things, planning who you're going to practice with that day. Are you going to use a hitting partner, or is it just going to be a feeding session with the coach? Or are we going to play practice sets? You're sort of in charge of dictating all of that, as you know, during the practice weeks or even leading up to the tournament. Yeah, like I said, for me, the job of the coach is to make the player have to their life as easy as possible so they can focus on what they need to do. She'll have gym a couple of times a week where she'll either do cardio or weightlifting, which I'll oversee. But usually they have a pro, you know, a fitness trainer that either travels with them or with us, or they'll, if they don't have a traveling fitness trainer, their trainer will send them the plan, and then I help them execute that in the gym. So, yeah, that's sort of the rough sort of schedule of a coach.
But yeah, I mean, that sounds like a lot of jobs, actually. I didn't realize that you did so much, you know, in terms of even sorting out the stringing of the rackets and stuff. It's almost like a manager. And looking at your career history, it looks like you've solely worked with women. So is there a difference between coaching men and coaching women?
You know, because I started with Martina, I think I just got, you know, tennis is a very, I'd say almost incestuous, you know, you have, once you're in that women's side, it's almost like a musical chairs where everyone, you get to know those people and they know you, and you just kind of get, I suppose, pigeonholed, not in a bad way, but you get into that, you know, environment, because a lot of the women's, other than the Grand Slams, which are only four times a year, the men and women are on completely different schedules pretty much. There's a few exceptions like Miami and Indian Wells, but for the most part, you know, women are playing in a different place to the men each week. So you don't even really mix with the men as much. I think the biggest thing in terms of difference of tennis is obviously the women's ability to serve as big is obviously not the same. Because of the physical limitations. And I think that men, their movement, their ability to move is often as good or sometimes even better than their ability to hit the ball. So like Murray, for example, he's probably a better mover than he is a better hitter of the ball. So I would say he's a better receiver than he is a sender, even though he's very good at both. Whereas on the women's side, I find it's a little bit more like, for example, Shelby, she sends the ball much better than she receives the ball. So her striking ability, or women in general, their striking ability is usually better than their moving ability, which is why I think on the women's you see a lot of, you know, first strike, bang, bang tennis.
Yeah. Yeah, really interesting. I hadn't even thought of it like that. But look, thinking about myself as a tennis player, you're pretty spot on there.
But you know, even if you look at Craig O'Shaughnessy, who's sort of considered, I suppose, the guru of statistics in tennis, and he's done a lot of longitudinal studies over this and come up with a lot of interesting information about what actually happens on the court, is so different to what most people think happens. I mean, I don't know what you would expect. I mean, what do you think is the average number of shots in a rally at recreational level?
Recreational level.
Okay, let's go through. So let's say a recreational player, what would you imagine is the average number of shots per?
About 10.
About 10, okay. And what about for college? Let's do college.
Okay.
Sort of American college.
A bit less. I think they want to hit win that point a lot sooner. So going for the kill a lot sooner. So probably about 6, if not less.
Okay, and pro?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot here now.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm interested because I'm not going to lie, I answered about the same.
Again, less. I think, again, they want to go for that winning shot early on. So 2 or 3.
Okay, yeah, I mean, you're very close. But the interesting thing was, is when he did this study, he's done this for years now, that from under 10s, 12s, 14s, 16s, 18s, college and pro, the average rally length is broken down into 3 categories, and 70% of tennis is under 4 shots.
Wow.
So that's at all levels. And that means 4 shots total. So 2 for you and 2 for me, not 4 each. That's
including the serve.
including the serve. So 70% is 0-4. About 20% is 5-8. And again, that means, you know, 8 would be 4 shots each, not 8 shots each. And then 10% is 9+.
Wow.
So, you know, what you think happens and what actually happens are very different.
Totally.
The most common, do you know what's really interesting? Do you know what is the most common rally length? So I've got to remember my math here. That's not the mean. It's not the median. I think it's the mode, which is the number that occurs most often, right?
Mode is most often.
Yep.
Well, from what you've just said, about 5-4.
The most common rally length is 1.
Oh, I should have known, of course. Yes.
Yeah, that's where either the server serves an ace, a service winner, or the returner misses the return.
Yeah,
that's the most common thing. That's the most common thing that happens in tennis. So you know, it kind of started when he brought that out a few years ago. It started to change the way people thought about the game a little bit and the way they trained, because so much of the time we're doing repetition training, running side to side, having these long rallies. But in reality, that's not what's actually happening in the match. So based on the fact that 0-4 is 70% of the time and the most common rally length is 1, it really sort of highlighted the importance of your serve and first shot and return and first shot.
And when you found out those stats, did that change the way that you coached?
It definitely made me rethink some things. I'll imagine that 99% of coaches, and I'm one of them, although I'm trying to change it, probably wait till the last 5 or 10 minutes to hit a few serves out of the basket.
Yeah, I can relate to
You know, but there's also a trade-off, because I think a lot of people, when they, especially on the recreational levels, you know, part of playing tennis is winning for sure, but it's a workout. You know, you want to run, you want to sweat, you want to feel like you really got something out of it. So it's a balance, but I thought that was interesting when you get those numbers and you break it down. And when you go watch Wimbledon, hopefully this year, if they have fans, if you can get there and watch and sort of think about those numbers, you'll see actually, you know, the long rallies that are really exciting, they're great. And you remember them because they're exciting, but you don't remember all the aces and the missed returns and the double faults and the unreturnables.
I'll have to get my notepad and pen out when it comes on. And also, in terms of your style of coaching, you've written a couple of articles based on coaching, and you wrote one a few years back about what a coach looks for in a student, and you put down some really illuminating things, and that your personality off court matches your type of play on court, and that there are only two types of tennis player: wild ones who need to be tamed, such as Nick Kyrgios, and caged ones who need to be freed, such as Andy Murray. That's a really interesting observation there. So could you expand on that?
Yeah, I'm glad someone read that article. I think my mum was the only one that did, but that's good to know two people did.
Absolutely.
For example, I was not a risk taker when I played. And I remember having a good friend that played, and he was the opposite. He was a big risk taker. He liked to hit the ball hard. And I said, we had a conversation one day, and I said, what would you do if you won $100,000 in the casino or on the lottery? And he said, I'd go buy a Ferrari. And he said, what would you do? And I said, I'd probably invest it in a 401k or a pension fund and leave it there and let it grow interest over the next 30 years.
Sounds terribly boring, Mark.
Exactly. And that's what made me think about it and say, you know what? It's kind of the way I played the game as well. It was boring. It was disciplined. It was monotonous. It was, you know, a lot of repetition, but it was that way. So in a big moment, you know, at 30 or 5 all in the third set, I'm probably not the guy that's going to look to hit a big serve and a winner off the first shot. I'm going to hit a solid first serve into the body and be ready to play a long point and work. Whereas he would go for probably an ace. And that was, you know, a sort of a reflection of his personality as well. And so you look at players like Andy Murray, and I think when he was playing his best tennis, he was more aggressive. When he won Wimbledon, he has obviously great movement, but he played with too much fear. Fear of, you know, losing, and obviously in England there's a lot of pressure on him, but I think that those years where he played better and won the Olympics, he was playing more free and more aggressive. You know, guys like Kyrgios, for example, these guys, you know, they have a lot of talent, but he doesn't have the discipline in the big moments. And I think that's where you see guys like Nadal, who is such a, you know, a one-off, where he's such a hard worker, but he's so disciplined on top of the talent, you know. I think that's so, and Federer as well. These guys are so unique. And I think we've been really spoiled for the last 15 years with having those guys around. In fact, I think it was, is it this week or next week will be the first time in maybe 15 years where the top two players in the world are not Federer, Nadal, Djokovic or Murray. Going to be Medvedev now, who's going to be number two, pushing Nadal down. So it's incredible what those guys have done, but I think they've got that combination mastered of being aggressive but disciplined at the same time.
And in terms of maximizing a tennis game, I mean, are there any general tricks of the trade that you can offer as advice? I mean, I know each player is different and you have to give different advice to different players, but are there any general tricks to improve a tennis game?
It's like anything, you need to put in the practice. I'm sure everyone is here listening to this has heard the 10,000 hour rule, which, you know, you need to have that amount of practice, deliberate practice. But, you know, I think a lot of people, when they play, probably pay too much attention to wanting to play well, rather, you know, and we're talking about competitive players here. A lot of the game is not just being better than your opponent to win, but can you make your opponent play worse? So if I'm playing somebody that's better than me tomorrow, I know that if I play them 10 times, they're probably going to win 9. The way I've got to try to beat them is make them play worse, because I know I can't play better. So I think a lot of players, too often, they focus on their side of the court. They don't pay attention. So they, oh, my forehand today doesn't feel good, or I don't serve as hard as them. But you don't need to. You need to say, well, what does he not want? You know, it's like, I think, what do they say? The best move in chess is not the best chess move. The best move in chess is the move that your opponent least wants you to make. And I think that that's quite, I think that's quite important. I think a lot of players, you know, need to sort of embrace their limitations and say, well, how can I beat this guy by making him play worse today?
And that also means studying the your opponent's techniques and how they like to play.
Exactly. I mean, most people are going to have a better forehand than a backhand, especially in the lower levels. But I think also as well, it's amazing how even at the pro level, so many players are paying attention to their side of the court. They're not paying attention to the other side of the court enough. And as a coach, that's our job, right? We are always watching what the other person is doing. And it, sometimes if you take a look down the other side, you can really see what the other person doesn't like to do or what they do really well. And then using that information to try and, you know, create the right game plan to beat that other player or that opponent. I think that's something that a lot of players don't do well enough.
That's totally turned around how I see my gameplay anyway. So that's such a brilliant bit of advice, and that's relevant to absolutely everyone. So that is spot on, Mark. Thank you so much. Yeah.
No, and we're really lucky now because there's so many, you know, videos on YouTube and you know, all of these, you know, instructional videos and videos of all these top players playing. I think it's great because you can get so much information. You have to be careful with it. And I think as well, I think the biggest problem is when you see, you know, a recreational or a lower level player watching Federer and they want to do what he's doing, you know, which is great in theory, but it's not always going to carry over that way. No. So you have to really, you know, sort of be aware of your own game. And I think that's where it starts. So many people are trying to play a game style that they can't play. And, you know, sort of check your ego at the door a little bit.
Yeah, if you know what I mean. Be realistic.
Yeah, you know, walk on and know. You know, that's why I love watching guys like Diego Schwartzman from Argentina or David Goffin from Belgium. I mean, these are guys are, you know, Diego Schwartzman is shorter than me. I think he's 5'5". And, you know, he's an outstanding player. And he's mastered sort of making the people he plays play worse than they normally do. And they always come off the court and say, I played terrible today. Every time. And he's a master of making you play worse. And that's all that matters.
Wow. Great bit of advice there. Thank you so much, Mark. If you ever come back to England, you must swing by the Caversham Lawn Tennis Club again and maybe give us some tips on court.
Absolutely. I'd love to come out there. I miss the club, and I'm sure there's some people there that are still there when I was there. I'd love to
see. Absolutely.
I'm really proud to come from that club. It's a great setup. It's a great location, and they always created such a nice community there.
Thank you so much again, Mark Gellard. Take care.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you.
Talking Tennis with Linda Cirque.
So how about that then? Wasn't that absolutely brilliant? A massive thank you to Mark Gellard for not only sharing his journey to becoming a top coach, but also his amazing tennis tips. I'll be sure to start practicing my serves a bit more as a result anyway. And as you heard, Mark started out playing tennis at the Caversham Lawn Tennis Club. And if you fancy playing a bit of tennis and you're based in or near Reading, come and join us. Head to caversham.ltc.co.uk to find out more. Thanks also to Ooeze, who's a brilliant DJ from Reading, and he has supplied the music for this podcast, and also to D. Ray Kickett from Slough, who did the voiceover for me. Please join me again in a couple of weeks' time, but until then, keep talking tennis. Bye-bye.